is Greenberg versus Seattle School District.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Mesplay. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Greenberg, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
This is a case about procedural error that resulted in the improper refusal to hear a meritorious declaratory judgment action. In this matter, the appellant, Mr. Greenberg, filed a complaint alternatively arguing for a statutory writ of review, a constitutional writ of review, and a declaratory judgment action.
Were they alternative, or was it these were just related?
They were in the alternative, which is permitted under the rules of pleading, Rule 8. A plaintiff is allowed to plead alternative causes of action and will at some point need to make the decision which of those causes of action he's going to and theories he's going to rely on, which he did in this case when in May of 2000 and I believe it was 2015, he moved for summary judgment on his declaratory action. The trial court ended up striking the hearing on the declaratory judgment because, in the trial court's view, he was required to comply with King County Local Rule 98.4. By its very terms, King County Local Rule 98.4 applies explicitly to writs of review, be they statutory or constitutional. It does not apply to summary judgment or to declaratory judgment actions. Declaratory judgment actions are governed by an entirely separate statute. They invoke entirely separate jurisdiction of the court, and
So the crux of your argument is the court erred in dismissing the declaratory judgment action.
Yes, that is correct.
Are you abandoning your writ action then?
We are not abandoning the writ action. We did not pursue that until the court informed us that we needed to. But the court erred in its initial decision to not even decide the declaratory judgment action.
Isn't it true that one thing that declaratory actions and writ actions have in common is that they presuppose that you don't have an adequate remedy at law?
That is correct.
So in this case, you had a hearing in front of the arbitrator.
So there was
the arbitrator, you say, well, he imposed a remedy that wasn't permitted because it was an adverse employment action.
That is correct.
But the arbitrator also issued a statement that the arbitrator was going to retain jurisdiction for 2 months in case anybody had any question about the remedy. Now, did your client communicate with the arbitrator during that 2 month period?
I do not believe he did.
And so isn't it not reasonable to assume that had your client written to the arbitrator and said, "Dear Mr. Arbitrator, you have imposed a remedy that is not something that you have the legal right to impose because under the statute it's an adverse employment action." And then is it not reasonable to assume that the arbitrator would have responded by saying, "Oh, well, nobody told me that. I guess I just took that off the top of my head, but since I still have jurisdiction for 2 months, let me take it under consideration and I'll provide a remedy to you that I do have the power to impose."
It's reasonable to assume that that might have happened. It's also reasonable to assume that the arbitrator might also have completely rejected that argument and said
no. Well, you would have had the opportunity to argue that to the arbitrator, but my point is that there was no communication taking advantage of this opening.
There was not.
And so why does that not lead inevitably to the conclusion that there was an adequate remedy at law, but your client simply failed to avail himself of it?
So the arbitrator's retaining jurisdiction and offering the chance to challenge his decision is essentially the equivalent of what in a court would be a motion for reconsideration, which is not a requirement to file an appeal by any means, so that if the appellant, or in this case Mr. Greenberg, felt that it would have been futile to discuss this to the arbitrator, Mr. Greenberg had no avenue to address his challenge beyond the arbitrator.
But that happens a lot, doesn't it? I mean, arbitration generally is not appealable, and yet we don't normally say that because you went to an arbitrator, you lacked an adequate remedy at law, do we?
No.
You can't appeal an arbitrator's decision, but if you agree by private contract, which your client did, to submit certain decisions to arbitration, you're proceeding on the assumption that you're going to accept the arbitrator's remedy and that you will not be able to appeal it if you don't like it. And so that would have been the case had the arbitrator not out of the blue come up with this 10-day suspension. Your client might not have liked it, but he wouldn't have been able to appeal it if the arbitrator had simply done what the district wanted him to.
That's correct.
So, but he did have the opportunity here to go back and say, you know, this remedy won't work. Please rethink.
He did have the opportunity. So it wasn't that the remedy didn't work. It isn't that he didn't like
the suspension.
It was illegal.
It was not something that the arbitrator could impose. But certainly the arbitrator didn't know that. No, nobody told him that, and you know, so maybe the arbitrator would have regretted the fact that he kind of made up as he went along a remedy that he didn't have the power to impose. It just seems to me, why would we want to countenance a situation where your client gets to now go through another hearing, have the same witnesses, everything, you know, now that we've straightened out that, you know, you have to have somebody. An arbitrator can't impose an adverse employment action. Why not just tell that to the arbitrator?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that the arbitrator didn't know that he couldn't impose that. He had a copy of the arbitration agreement, which laid out his authority, which specifically states that.
Yeah, but, you know, we can't. This goes to the writ argument, too. I mean, we cannot review the arbitrator's decision. The arbitrator doesn't have a record. This is not something the courts do. We don't review arbitrators' decisions and say, well, this is in the record. You knew this, like we would if he were a superior court.
So you can't review the arbitrator's decision on the merits, which is not what we're asking. We're not saying that the arbitrator was incorrect in imposing.
If you want to complete your thought.
Imposing the written reprimand. What we're saying is that the arbitrator exceeded his authority, and those questions are reviewable by this court and routinely are reviewed. And I will reserve.
Okay, you have your 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Craig Jackson. I represent the Seattle School District in this matter. I think the precise question was asked by the court, did the appellant in this case challenge the authority of the arbitrator to render this decision, or did the appellant stipulate to it? The record here is pretty clear that this arbitration began the same way that all arbitrations begin, with the arbitrator asking the parties to state the case. If the parties do not agree, then the arbitrator does what the arbitrators always do, and they say, do you agree that I have authority to frame the issue? In this case, the arbitrator asked that question of both the district and of the association, the union, and Mr. Greenberg. And Mr. Greenberg, by his representative, said, absolutely, you can frame the issue. The arbitrator did frame the issue when he rendered his decision and when he issued his award.
Well, I don't know if, do you think that the arbitrator can say anything he wants to? I mean, suppose that the arbitrator had said, okay, now that you've agreed that I can frame the issue, I hereby frame it as follows. Should Mr. Greenberg be subject to capital punishment if we find that indeed he did make a mistake in the way he taught this unit?
No, I do not think that the arbitrator could render.
So agreed. All right, but now so he what that would be, I would think we would agree, illegal. So he decided to stipulate it in such a way that allowed him to reach the result that he could impose the remedy of an adverse employment action. And that apparently is illegal. I don't see any dispute about that.
Well, I hesitate to agree with the question because of the way you formed it. You speak of an adverse employment action the same way the appellant has framed it in their briefs, but we're talking about RCW 48 or 28A405-310, RCW 28A405-300, and 340. None of those statutes refer to an adverse employment action. The statute specifically references whether there is an action against the contract of an employee. It does not speak to an adverse employment action.
Where does that phrase come from then?
That came from their brief, and it comes from discrimination law, at least employment discrimination law, but it is not contained anywhere in Chapter 28A405.
Is the right to enter an award that suspends rather than takes other action addressed?
The specifically, no.
I think that's why they're saying adverse employment action, because that's typically the kind of action that should be taken in an employment context.
The problem with their argument is that if you review the actual award, which is at Court's Papers 203, this is what the arbitrator's award, which is what you would have to appeal, this is what the award says. It states in section number one, the employer had just cause to discipline the grievant Jonathan Greenberg. I won't read the rest, but that's what it says. Number two, the employer did not have just cause to transfer grievant from center school. Certainly there isn't any problem with either of those two. Here's the third prong, which is what their challenge is based upon. The employer had just cause to suspend the grievant for a period of 10 working days without pay.
And that's his remedy. I mean, nobody had talked about that before.
Correct.
And so,
now, suppose he would have gone back to the arbitrator and made the argument he's making here, which is that, arbitrator, you do not have the power to impose that remedy. What would the arbitrator have? Would you have agreed or not? Setting aside the idea that maybe he waived that by his stipulation, but just on the face of it, do you think an arbitrator has the right to impose a 10-day suspension?
I don't think that the arbitrator's award did. The arbitrator said there was just cause for the district to do that.
Well, just humor me here. I mean, do you think that the arbitrator would have had the right to say, I think that the appropriate remedy is a 10-day suspension? Is this something that can come out of an arbitration hearing normally?
The case law on arbitrations, which is different from 28A405, which is what all of their arguments are based upon, is completely different. The case law on arbitration says that the arbitrator does have the authority to fashion an appropriate remedy. In this case, the arbitrator did fashion a remedy. And after fashioning that remedy, there was a subsequent hearing with the arbitrator on whether or not his opinion was implemented correctly, and that was on August 24th. The appellant appeared for that hearing with his representatives, and during that hearing, the appellant did not say anything about the imposition of a 10-day suspension.
So the appellant, or here we have Mr. Greenberg, could have at that hearing challenged the arbitrator's award that addressed just cause to impose 10-day suspension.
Absolutely.
You say this was a hearing that occurred in August of 2014?
Correct.
Is that in the record?
It is. Okay. If you look at Court Papers 236, there is a letter written by me to the arbitrator and to the other side, and it indicates that I was seeking clarification of the ruling. And in the letter, I indicate I have proposed a 10-day suspension letter to remove the old one, but and ask for a hearing for the arbitrator to determine whether or not that decision was in compliance with his ruling.
So do we have anything in the record that shows that such hearing took place?
Yes, there is a declaration from me. And I am looking for the...
The arbitrator's proceeding was not of record.
It was a telephone call, but it was not of record.
Okay.
And the appellant appeared for this hearing and did not object to the 10-day decision.
All right, so someplace in the record is your declaration.
That is correct. It's attached to the district's opposition to their motion for summary judgment. There is a declaration from me with the letter to the arbitrator.
And you say in that declaration that the hearing took place, even by phone?
Correct. And I apologize because I do not have it right here, but it is in the record.
Well, so is it fair to say then that your position is that the proceeding before the arbitrator was an adequate remedy at law for purposes of either the DEC action or the writ?
Yes, it was. Additionally, after the district issued its letter saying that we are imposing a suspension, the appellant had another adequate remedy at law under 28A405.310, at least that's their argument. Their argument is that under 28A405.310, they could challenge this decision, yet they didn't challenge the decision within 10 days.
Challenge the arbitrator's decision or the district's decision?
The district's decision to impose a 10-day suspension. They say they were entitled to a hearing, but they didn't request it within 10 days. In fact, they didn't request a hearing until 3 months later in December. And so they had another available adequate remedy, if you believe their argument, under 28A405.310, and they did not execute that other available remedy timely. They sat on.
When you just say the district's decision, I take it that relates to your prior comment about a substitution of a 10-day letter?
Correct.
Okay.
Because the arbitrator's award did not impose a 10-day suspension, it would be the subsequent letter of the district saying we are going to impose a 10-day suspension, and they didn't challenge that either timely under the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Regarding the district's argument about its September letter, so RCW 28A405.310 provides for an avenue for a teacher or other certificated employee to challenge a letter of probable cause issued by the district. What the district issued in September was not a letter of probable cause. What the letter said was, we agree with the decision of the arbitrator, we're going to impose this 10-day suspension eventually. It did not say we believe, in accordance with the arbitrator's decision, that there is probable cause. It was not a probable cause letter. It did not function as such. And the district's response to Mr. Greenberg's appeal in December indicates that they did not consider either its December letter or its September letter to be a probable cause decision that was appealable via 28A405.310.
If it wasn't a probable cause letter, how would you characterize it? A letter of announcement of discipline?
Yes.
And is there no way under the statute to challenge those without going to court first?
Correct. So in that situation, you run into what is similar to what happened in the City of Lakewood case, where there were procedures that the city was supposed to follow in responding to a petition. It didn't follow those procedures. The petitioner had no other option other than to simply go to court. Here, the district, if it was going to impose a new form of suspension or a new form of discipline, i.e. the suspension, it had to issue a probable cause letter. It didn't. Given that the procedures were not followed, Mr. Greenberg had no other option other than to take this directly to court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That can